Chang's been in the Vipassana Theravada tradition, but I've also had one foot kind of in the Zen tradition as well. One of my, I guess, core teachers is a woman named Trudy Goodman, who lives in Los Angeles. And Trudy trained in the beginning with a few Zen teachers and was a Zen teacher herself. So before she switched over to the Vipassana lineage, she had spent a couple decades practicing with various Zen teachers like Koban Chino and Sun Sinim, the Korean teacher, and also Maureen Stewart Roshi. So when we started practicing with her, when Emily and I started doing intensive training with her, we didn't realize at the time, but we were getting a very strong Zen flavor of Vipassana. And so that's really informed my practice and my kind of approach to training. So as you could guess from the question, I wanted to explore this topic or this question: are there stages of practice, or are there stages of consciousness? That'd be another way of asking it. And I did want to get a feel for, you know, how people in this room approach that question. And I got the strong sense that it's a very Zen response to the question. Don't know, beginner's mind, starting again and again, which is beautiful. And I hope to include that wisdom into this exploration. So my response to the question, are there stages of practice, is it's a qualified yes. There could be stages of practice. There might be. But there's also many ways in which those stages aren't linear. And there's many ways in which they don't actually hold up. So I want to kind of talk about how there might be stages and sort of lay out a very simple stage model for you. And then also then end by talking about all the ways that that model doesn't really work. So... And I'd sort of point out as a historical point that some teachers and traditions, both Buddhist and non-Buddhist, some of them focus on stages and recognize stages, and others don't. Within the Buddhist tradition, you have stage models in all of the major traditions that I'm aware of. In the Theravada tradition, you have the 16 stages of the progress of insight leading up to enlightenment. You have the four stages of enlightenment, which once you get through the 16, then you've got four more to go. You've got the eight concentration absorption states. In Zen, you know, there's the 10 oxherding pictures, which can be understood as a stage model. There's Tozan's five ranks, five stages, which can also be understood as a stage model, but it's not always. Within the Tibetan tradition, you have the 10 bodhisattva bhumis and the five stages of the path. So all of these traditions had people who, at some point or another, looked back at their own experience or at others and said, oh, there seems to be some sort of progression here, some sort of development. And then within all of those traditions, there were other people who thought that was completely unhelpful to talk about it in those terms and who really de-emphasized that or even actively tried to pull the rug out from under that kind of thinking. So the stage model I want to share with you is it's really simple. It's basically just three stages. There's the stage leading up to the realization of emptiness. There is then the process of stabilizing that or of having our ideas about it destabilized. And then there's a process or a phase or stage of seeing that that realization of emptiness actually wasn't separate to begin with everything else. So the form is emptiness, emptiness is form stage. And I'll start, and this is a bit from my Vipassana training actually, this way of thinking. I'll start with a developmental psychologist from Harvard. He studied, Robert Keegan's his name, and he studied adult development for longitudinally for like 20 or 30 years. He saw how adults go through a change in how they make meaning in the world and how they make meaning of themselves. And in doing so, he saw that there were these kind of general movements of development that people, when they responded in certain ways, they usually then didn't go back years later. There tended to be a kind of general movement toward a certain direction. And he summarized kind of the way that stages happen by with this quote. He said, "The subject of one stage," meaning the I, the sense of I, the subject, "becomes the object of the subject of the next stage." So I'll say that again. The subject of one stage, the sense of I at one stage, becomes an object to the sense of I, to the subject of the next stage. So if you imagine like a circle, a concentric circle, that's the sense of I. That with development, there's a sense of almost like expanding that sense of I and then becoming aware of what we previously took as I, as the subject. So I like that description because it also, for me, describes part of what I've seen happen with myself and with others doing meditation training. And that is that we systematically objectify or start to see as objects all of these different sensations that arise in our experience. So sensations come in different, you know, flavors and tones. There are body sensations, which I think for most people are like the most obvious and gross forms of sensation. It's not that hard to realize when you feel a sensation that that's not you. You know, if you feel your leg aching a little, you don't think, oh, I'm aching. You think, oh, my leg is aching. And then there are emotions, which are much more subtle usually for people, which are kind of like patterns of body and mind coming together. And then there are thoughts, which in some ways are some of the most subtle sensations that we experience. We often can't even see them as objects. It just immediately we feel like we are the stories that are arising in our minds. And then there are other complex mental phenomena like intention and attention, and investigation or inquiry, things that are very, very subtle, that are very hard to see, but which arise in our experience. So the practice of Vipassana for me was a practice of systematically seeing all of these things arising in my experience and seeing them as objects, of actually being able to notice them, to notice what I'm noticing as I'm noticing it, to see, oh, this thought is arising in my experience as a visual image or as an auditory tone or as a kinesthetic sense. It's not actually me. It's arising. It's present. I can take it as an object. The tricky part with that is when the sense of the observer also becomes an object, because Vipassana has the very big downside of, in some sense, creating a split between the one who's watching and that which is being watched. But it actually responds to that split quite nicely, because at some point you start to see that all the sensations that make up the sense of being a watcher or an observer, being the one who's on this side of my face seeing these sensations arise, is also part of the sensate field, is also part of what's arising. So consciousness starts to take itself as an object, and everything starts to take itself as an object. And in that sense, at some point in the training of Vipassana, there's a great sense of equanimity or stability of mind where one isn't taking oneself to be certain thoughts that are arising as much. And at that point, everything is kind of arising as an object in awareness. And in that sense, everything is also arising as the subject in awareness. There is no actually distinction between objects and subjects at that point, because it's just this. And it's that at that point that the realization of emptiness, in my experience, can happen. It can shine forth by itself. So I would say all of the process leading up to that, from a certain point of view, is like a stage. It's like a process of seeing all the things that catch us, that we take as I or as mine, and then being able to observe them, being able to notice them, and let them go. And at that point, I think this is where Zen comes in for me. At that point, there's really a sense of experiencing this whole field of awareness, everything that's arising in your mind, as a unified field. There's a sense that experience and the awareness of that experience is co-arising, it's coming together. There's just what's happening, and it's just happening by itself. And when that realization happens, there's different names for it. In the tradition that we've trained in, they talk about entering the stream, which I guess means like you basically get to a point where you're in a current that has you. You're not doing it anymore. So one of our teachers told us at a certain point on retreat, we came in to interview with her, and she's like, "Don't forget, you know, you're not doing this process. This process is doing you." So I think at some point we realize that. Then it's not really in our hands as much anymore. It's just sort of happening. We're getting taken down the stream. Dogen Zenji also, I think, describes this perhaps when he talks about dropping off body and mind, that there's an experience of when there's nothing to hold on to and there's no one to do the holding, something drops out, the bottom drops out. And then it comes back together, unfortunately. Sometimes it's unfortunate. It feels unfortunate that it comes back together. I've been reading Zen Master Hong Si's writings lately, and he was describing, I think, this in a really beautiful way. He said, "Vast and spacious, like sky and water merging during autumn, like snow and moon having the same color, this field is without boundary, beyond direction, magnificently one entity without edge or seam." So I think he's kind of describing this understanding that dawns when you see that this entire sensory field is boundaryless. There's no edges, there's no seams. It's just this one unified experience that's arising when we're not holding on or grasping, or when experience isn't holding on or grasping to itself. Then it's experienced that way. But, and this is the tricky part, we tend to, I think, as practitioners, we tend to reify that understanding really rapidly. We tend to thingify it. We tend to turn it into a concept or into a thing that we can then kind of wrap our minds around and go, "Oh yeah, that was emptiness, that experience that I had, or that thing that I saw, or that time when I wasn't there. That was emptiness." Actually, I was on a retreat several years ago, and I kind of was doing something like this. I was really holding on to the idea of emptiness, that I could experience emptiness. And I came into the teacher, and I was really just pissed. And I said, "Wait a second, I thought the Buddha said that emptiness was a refuge. I thought this was something you could take as refuge." And she sort of looked at me and was like, "Yeah, that's not really the understanding of emptiness, actually." And what I realized later is that I was trying to have a stable idea of emptiness to take refuge in, this idea of some experience that I was having. And it was actually, the reason I was so pissed is because I was having to let go of that idea, that there wasn't something I could hold on to. Shinzen Young describes emptiness this way. He says, "Emptiness is not a thing. It's a pure doing. It's a pure activity." Hong Si again. "Everywhere sense faculties and objects both just happen." So I think these are pointing to the similar thing. Everywhere sensations are just arising. They're just happening on their own, without any need for us to be there to observe them, to make them happen. And this is where it starts to get into the, I would say, the stage of no more emptiness, or emptiness and form being the same, the stage of the non-duality of those two. Because once we realize there's not a way to thingify emptiness or to turn it into a subtle experience of spaciousness or calm or clarity, then I think we're left with just this human experience. Even if it's boundaryless, it doesn't mean it's special. It's pretty normal and pretty ordinary, even though we can make ourselves special and ordinary, or non-ordinary, for recognizing that. And at some point, there's just the pure doing, the pure activity, and there's nothing to be special anymore. And that's I'd say that's also a phase of practice, or a stage of practice, or it could be described that way. And in some ways, that stage is characterized by the sense of letting go of stages. That's what's really interesting to me, that one can let go of the idea of having to get somewhere or become something and really be okay with that, and that really be one's grounding point. And I heard a lot of that kind of in people's descriptions of where they think they might be. Okay, so that's my simple stage model. Now I want to sort of describe why that is not really true. One reason is because we can have temporary glimpses of any of what I just described at any point. Inside a Buddhist context, outside of a Buddhist context, one of our teachers, Trudy Goodman, who I mentioned before, her first opening was really while giving birth to her daughter. And that happened prior to meeting any sort of Zen context. And she had this incredible opening and clarity about the nature of reality. And I think for many people that happens. You know, that's part of what brings them to train and to practice. So there's a way in which, because we can have that understanding at any moment, then the idea of having to go through multiple stages to get there doesn't really work. And I think this is what one of my early influences, Ken Wilber, described as the difference between a state and a stage. And that's why it's also a little tricky, because one can have a glimpse, but that doesn't mean it's stable. That doesn't mean one gets that all the time. Doesn't mean one, you know, understands that what was being revealed to them, even while they're, you know, in the middle of a fight with their partner, or you know, while they're cooking food, or while they're at work, you know, browsing the internet like I do, you know, 8 hours a day. So it's also tricky, that piece. And then there's the other part that I mentioned, which is that another way that this is not really stage-like is that at a certain phase or stage, it's clear that all stages are just ideas and concepts that arise in the mind, and that, you know, those things arise and they pass away, and that we can't really hold on to them as fixed things. And we see that in our own conscious experience, there's no such thing as a stage. There's just thoughts about stages and where I am and where I've been. So that's another way that stages don't really hold up. But I think it's important to remember that that is from the perspective of consciousness and emptiness, and that we still have minds, and we still can reflect, like Robert Keegan did, on the past, and we can see trends and patterns. So it doesn't completely negate that capacity, you know, to take a third-person perspective and to see something arising in time. But I think it's important that we don't conflate those as well. Another way that these stages aren't linear is that there's also, I think everyone probably noticed that there's like a circular dimension to practice. That there are cycles. So it's not just that we kind of go up and up and up, but actually like we cycle more like a spiral that keeps going through broader waves. And something's understood and realized, I hope, you know, after 10, 20, 30 years, there's some reason we're doing this still. But there are phases and waves where it's like suddenly everything one thinks one's understood, like, drops away, or one's pissed because they can't, you know, find refuge in emptiness, or one just can't focus. It's really hard to concentrate suddenly. It's like one's attention just becomes really everywhere, whereas maybe a couple days before you could really focus and see everything that was arising and not get stuck in anything. So there's this kind of circular dimension too, where we kind of find ourselves looping back to where we started, and then as someone, you know, as a few of you said, coming back again and again, there's this sort of circular dimension. So that's another way that these stages aren't really linear. And then the last way that they're not linear is that people are different, actually. People are quite different. And so some people find it really easy to understand certain things. I don't know if you've noticed this. Like as soon as they sit down to learn something or do something, it's like they just get it immediately. Or maybe they got it before from somewhere else, and it's not like a big deal to them. They don't have to go through a big process of trying to figure it out. Like, they just get it. And then for others of us, It takes us like maybe a whole lifetime to get something really simple and really basic. And for whatever reason, we just have a really hard time with certain things. So there are those outliers, you know, those people that don't really fit into a linear progression because they either get it so quickly or take so long to get it that it's really hard to see that they fit into any sort of map. And then there's the other part of this, which I've noticed from working with students and teaching meditation techniques, is that not everyone actually perceives reality the same either. You know, some people are more dominant in certain ways of perceiving. They perceive things more kinesthetically or more visually or more auditorily. We were just talking to someone at Disney Animation Studios who said, I can't visualize. I can't actually bring up or call to mind any sort of mental visualization. And in fact, he said, one of the master hand-drawing animators at Disney, you know, this is one of the old school people who his whole art is about to really, you know, disappear because we've moved to digital. That person also confided in our friend that they too could not visualize. So somehow they learned how to become one of the most master animators in the world without being able to bring to mind a visualization in their mind. So people are really staggeringly different sometimes in how they experience things. And if you have a model, a stage model or a conception that says, oh, well, at this stage you should be experiencing, you know, bright lights or shimmering, you know, luminosity. Well, that doesn't really work for someone who can't visualize anything, you know. So that person doesn't really fit into that stage model. And ultimately, I think this is why these stage models break down at some level completely, because a theory or a map or a model that we have to describe reality, no matter how precise it is and how much like study we've done and how many people we've seen go through these things, in some sense, when we're applying that idea to reality, reality is always breaking our concepts. It's always showing us that our conceptions are limited, that there is more. And so for me, a stage model is only ever really a working model. It's a tool that can support us at times to see that, in fact, what we're going through is normal, it's okay, and that other people before us and currently are also exploring some of the same vistas and some of the same aspects of consciousness and have been for thousands of years. And in that sense, I think we can take refuge in the practice of others and in the fact that we are somewhat similar. We're not completely different. And that in that sense, we're doing this together. And yet, we can't really ever rest on our laurels or with our models because reality continues to change. And so that's my attempt at sharing some thoughts on stages of practice. And I hope it's more helpful than it is confusing. So thank you for your time and attention. Appreciate it.
Questions?
Sure. Yeah. We have time.
Question. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Do you think, like, Dogen and all the, you know, the six patriarchs, do you think they were in that space of pure doing a lot of the time, that one-pointedness of the being in the stream?
I don't know. I mean, when I read Dogen's writing, it sounds like that, but it's hard to know. What do you think?
I get the sense they were, and I was thinking, well, then, is it because, you know, we're in this modern, is it that much harder for us moderns? You know, we've got neon lights and airplane noises, and we've got more distractions and more nervous environment that we live in, pretty much, you know, from their quiet world, although they had to do the chopping and keep off, I'm sure, wild animals, but I'm wondering...
And occasional, like, starvation, you know.
Yeah. You know, which causes a bit of stress, but yeah. I just was, you know, all these, the great literature that we have and these sutras and these teachings and all the koans, you know, the one, they got it, you know, the prick of the needle. It makes me sense that those people had somehow that they were living a great bit of their time in that stream. Mm. And I was just wondering what you thought. You said you don't know.
I certainly hope so, but I don't know, because it's hard. It's hard for me to get too certain about it, because I don't really know, you know, what's coming next. I don't really know where my practice is going. So I've just noticed a tendency to project where my ideals onto past figures and to think, oh yeah, they were like living in this complete, you know, perfect realization of, you know, and then I'm like, oh, wait a second, is that just my idea of what should be happening here? And that's where it gets tricky, the way we project our ideals, you know, back onto these poor people that can't defend themselves.
I don't think they were quite... They seem pretty... I don't know, the Coens and things and the stories, you know, I mean, it's like, huh? And yeah. It seems like they understand and get transmitted immediately between teacher and someone, and that just, you know, just that storytelling of it seems quite a metaphor.
Yeah.
I remember Rev Anderson, when he was talking about the Coen, these wonderful stories that we have, the Coens, and that he emphasized that what's not told in these stories is the background, and the background is intensive practice. These people practiced a lot, and they had the practice had a very visible form to it. Mm-hmm. And but the stories just tell this wonderful little, you know, little conversation between this Zen master and the student. You know. But the background is all this intensive practice. So.
9 years of facing a wall.
Yeah.
excuse me. That process you described, where the subject of one stage becomes the object of the subject of the next stage.
Nice. Good memory.
Doesn't it? I'm into grammar and things. Doesn't it? Doesn't it just happen temporally? How do I know I'm advancing? How do I know I'm moving up and not just forward?
I mean, what one thing I've noticed with this is it applies to oneself. You know, that we start to see certain things arising as objects, you know, which means we're not thrown off by them. But it also happens with other people. So we can hear other people describe something, say in their practice or about their life, that we used to struggle with, that we used to like really catch us, and then no longer does it catch us. It's just, we just see it arising, and we're not caught by it. So I think that's one way I've used to gauge if this stuff is for real, is like, to what degree am I not being constantly thrown off center by other people's suffering and difficulty, and to what degree can I respond with a care and compassion, because it's not catching me so tightly. So that'd be one way I'd say we can gauge, is like using each other, you know, as a
sangha.
Yeah, sangha. Yeah, that's one way to look at it.
Could I ask a follow-on to that?
Yeah, please.
In that model, first you have the infinite regression, because you never get any place. You're just always backing up.
Mm.
And the levels and stages that you describe actually are quite finite.
Mm-hmm. In my experience, it isn't infinite. There is a point at which one sees what's arising, but then it changes. So, so in that sense, maybe it's like more like there are plateaus. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I guess in that sense, there is. I think there is a possibility for an infinite unfolding. At least that's the model I find most comforting.
Downhill.
What's that?
Maybe it's infinite going downhill, where you're just getting caught up more and more to a regression.
So you're saying like the anti-stage, like it's getting worse and worse.
Yeah, your ego is developing that regression.
Or better and better. I mean, it's
yeah.
Putting it into better and, you know, worse and worse becomes a...
A release, or dropping off.
Well, it can be a dropping off, so yeah, but worse is a word that I respond to in... like, wait a second, because it's It's divisive and highly dualistic. And stages, for me anyway, it's more like the whole Buddhist idea of change. There are changes. It doesn't necessarily mean, there's some, in some ways with practice, I've gotten worse. And in some ways, if you wish, I've gotten better. But it's not about getting better or worse. It's that the changes happen. And I know, I'm aware of the changes happening. But I'm not quite sure how, I just got Dharma transmission. Is that a stage? Well, not really. You know, it's sort of a superficial stage on some level. And but there have been changes in my life. And I feel like labeling them is dangerous. Experiencing them is necessary.
And I would just throw out the counter perspective, from the stage model is not labeling them can also be dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
Not recognizing how we change and not making distinctions in our practice and seeing, oh, this is this, this is that. Mm-hmm. That also can be, can create its own dualism to think, that we can't distinguish things.
I didn't say that quite. It's the labeling process that experiencing something and that moment where you're not labeling it and allowing it, just experiencing it is, yes, you can label it later, but the important time, which is that odd arising.
Yes, I think I understand. So are you basically saying there are moments and times when it's more helpful you found to just let things be what they are,
as long as you can.
Yeah, and then maybe there are other times that it's helpful to reflect back on things and to and to label things. Yeah, sure, that makes sense to me. Are we good on time?
Yeah,
I wanted to ask. You have an organization called Buddhist Geeks.
Yes.
Do you think that your teaching is somehow especially helpful to people who work in the field of geekism, or whatever that people who work with computers.
Yeah.
In the digital world. And I was wondering what it is about that world that you can teach, that you can teach people about, such that practice interfaces with that world.
Mm.
There must be a particular approach that you have based on that orientation.
Yeah, I mean, there's a particular approach based on being a geek myself. I think.
Doing something this afternoon.
Yeah, we're doing a heart hacking workshop, which is a bit of our kind of geeky way of talking about developing and cultivating.
How is
the heart.
It different from any other workshop about Buddhism?
I think the only difference is just in the way that we're talking about things, and it's sort of in the language and in the approach of. In some sense, it relates to this talk because it's like not being afraid of using the conceptual mind as a tool in order to practice well, but then also recognizing its limitations. So for me, like, I've always had a very particular kind of mind, that's very analytical. And for me, looking at things in terms of engineering or hacking or programming makes a lot of sense. As these are systems, you know, the consciousness and the body is a system, and that it can be understood, mm-hmm. it can be reprogrammed. You know, that way of looking at it is kind of what is how we're framing how we teach, you know, Emily and I. So I don't think it's really fundamentally different. I think you see that attitude and ethos in the Buddhist tradition for sure. But I'm not sure if that responds.
Well, that did respond very nicely, I thought. What is hacking?
Come this afternoon and find out.
Sorry. I want to know now.
Real simply, hacking is a way of getting into an operating system and bypassing the normal security guards so that you can then either understand it or change it. And it can be done maliciously, or it can be done with different, like, positive intentions. So, just like everything.
And it relates to Buddhism?
In the sense that that our experience is like an operating system, that our mind is like, it's like this thing that's running all these various programs and beliefs, and you know, we can look at our experience that way.
The metaphor.
It's a metaphor. It's a geeky metaphor.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thank you.
Question. So, Buddhism is this monastic tradition that's always relied on three basic elements: Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. And then, as we bring it into America, it's no longer a monastic practice. So,
right.
How can we access Sangha in our life? That seems to be, to me, the greatest challenge in American Buddhism, is we can maybe come here and listen to talk, and we can know about Dharma, but Sangha, you know, in Buddha we can read about and talk with teachers about, but Sangha, how do we access Sangha?
I guess it depends on what we mean by Sangha. Like in the broadest sense, Sangha as like other people that you have to relate to, that broadest sense of Sangha is like we can't avoid Sangha. That'd be one way of answering. And then if you mean Sangha, I think you more mean Sangha in terms of other people that are practicing and doing similar stuff. I think the internet is actually a really good way to respond to that challenge. You know, for us, we've been doing most of our teaching online and working with people on video chat and things like that. And at first, that concept seems kind of crazy, especially if you have a lot of experience being with other people. Because in some sense, this is the most impressive form of virtual reality that we have right here. You know, all of the senses are fully engaged, and we're able to see, smell, taste, touch, all of that. With each other directly, but I think there's something to be said for being able to see each other and hear each other and connect with each other at a distance, and those technologies are really improving quite quickly. You know, we talked last night about virtual reality. Virtual reality is really only, consumer virtual reality is really only 3 to 5 years away, where people are going to be in very immersive visual auditory reality. So I think using those technologies of connection and communication are really will support a lot of people that may not have access to, like an amazing place like this, or who may have access to things but they don't quite connect with the communities that are there. So that's a little bit about how we've been thinking about it. But then again, we're geeks, so we might be more okay with a slightly less embodied form of connection. At least temporarily.